From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, clairvoyancy. Here's what's happening. The gunman who opened fire in a Texas Baptist church on Sunday, killing at least 26 people, was once convicted of assault after he reportedly fractured his infant stepson's skull. Before 26-year-old Devin Kelly received a bad conduct discharge from the U.S. Air Force back in 2014, he was court-martialed in 2012 for assaulting his wife and child. Kelly intentionally fractured his stepson's skull. As punishment, Kelly was confined in military prison for 12 months, received a reduction in military rank, and was discharged for bad conduct. Now, that's a step above a dishonorable discharge. But the big story, of course, that we talked about last night on the program, how did this guy, convicted of these felonies, how did he obtain his rifle? How did he get this? Well, according to the Air Force, they apparently failed to enter his assault conviction into the federal database. Kelly was given a bad conduct discharge, as I mentioned, and he would have been prohibited from possessing a firearm under federal law. Dr. John Lott with us, More Guns, Less Crime author. John, the system failed this time, did it not?
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty clear. It's not like I think that background checks are some magic cure to make sure that somebody can't get a gun. I mean, this guy bought this gun back in April of last year, and to think that if he was intent on killing people, he couldn't have gotten it, but it made it easier for him to do it.
And that's right.
You know, the irony is that during this mistake occurred during the Obama administration when President Obama was talking about expanding the system, and yet they couldn't run apparently the existing system well.
And had they put this into the database when he went to get his rifle, what would have happened?
Well, he would have been denied being able to do it, and then presumably they would have tried to prosecute him for committing perjury, because on the form, he said that he didn't have any pre-existing instances that would have prevented him from buying it. And yet it would have come up that he had this domestic violence misdemeanor.
Absolutely. John, thank you so much. John's website, crimeresearch.org. What a story. And of course, last night we were theorizing on just why was he going into that church? Well, we find out today that he went after some of his in-laws. He was sending them hateful text messages, and they went to that church, and just craziness, just craziness. John, thank you again. As President Trump sets foot on the first time of the Korean Peninsula, North Korea has rolled out its twisted version of the red carpet, mocking President Trump as a lunatic old man and sparking fears that a missile or nuke test could be imminent. Dr. John Curtis with us, onlinecolumnist.com. John, one more launch. That's my prediction. Something's going to happen.
Well, I think something will happen if there is a launch, but I mean, they have North Korea surrounded right now. You're talking about the major U.S. assets in the Pacific are surrounding North Korea, Japan, Guam, I mean, the Philippines. We have so many assets in place right now. This guy will not know what hit him if he does something stupid.
Well, and even China, John, even China has warned him no more nuke tests.
Exactly. And I think, you know, Trump intends to, you know, meet with Putin on the sidelines of the East Asia summit in about 5 days or so. He's extended his trip. And I think he's really going to try to bring Vladimir Putin on board. But one thing that folks need to understand about Trump's rhetoric, and I think it's spun so badly in the media right now as being provocative, it is in fact diplomacy. Because really, George, anything short of, you know, missiles flying or bombs dropping is diplomacy. He's trying to bring China on board and Putin to apply maximum pressure for Kim to disarm. Now, Trump has said that the days of appeasement are over, that the time for talk is finished. And what he's referring to there is that Kim is the estimates by many different CIA folks and military experts is that Kim is approximately 6 months away from a completed ballistic missile, nuclear-tipped ballistic missile. Trump cannot allow that to take place.
No, because what? My biggest concern is that this whack job will set off a nuke in the atmosphere above us, creating an EMP, shutting down the power grid.
He could paralyze this country instantly without doing any particular property damage per se, but paralyzing that power grid. But I think, you know, the South Korean foreign minister today giving an interview with the U.S. press said that we cannot resolve this problem any way other than diplomacy. And I think that while that's a nice, expectation on her part, Trump has put the South Koreans on notice that he will not appease Kim Jong-un, and that disarmament will be the condition of any kind of a settlement with the U.S.
Dr. John Curtis's website, onlinecolumnist.com. John, thank you so much. One of the world's richest men, who has been the longtime face of Saudi Arabia's outreach to the West, remained locked up in a five-star hotel following a weekend shakeup of the kingdom's royal family. The reshuffling occurred as Saudi King Salman swore in new officials to replace those arrested in the sweeping anti-corruption probe. Billionaire investor Prince Alawid bin Talal, who is the nephew of the king and is worth about $18 billion, is reportedly being held at the country's Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh, along with 10 other princes and 38 officials. Rumors swirled the royals were receiving this five-star accommodation treatment when the luxury hotel was evacuated Saturday. An airport for private planes was also closed, possibly to prevent some of these business people from fleeing from the airport. People across the nation experienced internet problems Monday, according to service providers and the reports fielded by downdetector.com. They're still trying to figure out exactly what happened, but the areas covering some of the country's major metropolitan areas, including Boston, New York, Seattle, and San Francisco. Singer Robert Knight, best known for the 1967 country soul hit Everlasting Love, has died at the age of 72. Knight passed away on Sunday night following a short, undisclosed illness. It's a great song. Great song indeed. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is cracking down on companies, it says, are making unsubstantiated claims that certain products made from marijuana can cure cancer. They're saying no, 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 no. William Shatner is boldly going to Mars. Well, his name is, anyways. The actor who famously portrayed Captain James T. Kirk in the original Star Trek TV series and a number of movies is one of the more than 2.4 million people who have signed up to send their names to Mars aboard NASA's InSight lander. Dr. Sky Stephen Cates with us with his weekly report on what's going on in the skies. Is your name in this batch?
Well, that's pretty interesting, George. Just a fascinating story itself. But I think that someday, hopefully soon, we will, of course, see ourselves, meaning humans, on the surface of Mars. But one of the things, George, I wanted to mention, there's so many planetary spacecraft out there that are doing their busy work, and they're doing amazing things. But one that I wanted to highlight to the Coast audience, remember back in 1977, the launch of Voyager 1. This is the first, George, manned spacecraft to ever enter interstellar space. And that occurred officially back in August of 2012. This is hard to believe. The spacecraft is still functioning with majority of its instrumentation. It was launched 40 years, 2 months, and a day ago. Now, get a load of this, folks. 13.15 billion miles away from the Earth. So if you send, George, a signal to Voyager 1, it takes 19 hours and 32 minutes at the speed of light
to get there.
So many other spacecraft to talk about. The Dawn spacecraft, operating and functioning well. OSIRIS-REx, on its way to an asteroid. Japanese Hayabusa 2, working well, on its way to an asteroid. And the Juno spacecraft around Jupiter makes some incredible science. But George, the live sky, what everybody tells me they enjoy. The moon goes to its last quarter, coming up on the 10th. An opportunity, if you look into the skies and to the northeast, starting over the weekend, a short but intense burst of these slow fireballs called the Northern Torrid Meteor Stream may exist. We've seen them before, a few, but the bright ones are important. And then we saved the best for last, George. Monday on the 13th, we will find ourselves seeing the most amazing conjunction of Jupiter and Venus, as I mentioned last week. Look in the morning sky into the southeast. George, on the morning of the 13th, it's happening now and you can watch it during the week, primarily best on the 13th. The closeness of this object, these two objects, less than about a third of the diameter of the full moon, quite spectacular. Dr. Sky always reminds everybody, of course, to always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. Email me at drsky@cox.net and check out our aviation and space website, photorecon.net. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Stephen. Always good to talk with you and get those Monday reports about what's going on up there in the cosmos. It's been reported that about 150 Americans have tried to sign up with Al-Qaeda or ISIS in the Middle East. 150. There could be much more. In a moment, Robert Young Pelton joins us, the Explorer. We're going to talk about that and some other issues next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with our special guest for the next couple hours, Robert Young Pelton. He is a journalist. He is an explorer. He is a photographer, adventurer, author. A couple of his books, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and also The World's Most Dangerous Places. He has trained Navy SEALs in survival, participated in secret special forces training, motivates a lot of young people to do meaningful things with this short time that we are on this planet. Robert, welcome. Lots to talk about with you, my friend, but how are you?
I'm doing good. It's always a pleasure to do this show.
This number that I saw that said about 150 Americans have tried to enlist with ISIS or Al-Qaeda, and it could be even higher. How do they find these people? How do they get them?
Well, strangely enough, a lot of them are on social media, and they like to post pictures and sort of declare themselves, and that's one of the problems, and that's why they have such short lifespans. But the reality is nobody knows how many people joined or left or tried to join up. And what we're finding now is it's easier for them to stay home. So you're starting to see these lone wolf or sort of solo operators
now. Yeah. Well, I like that whack job from Uzbekistan and saying that he's influenced by. Should social media be doing a better job? And I mean these companies, Facebook and Instagram and those, weeding these kinds of people out and just deleting their accounts?
Well, it's a very good point. So there's a big organization in Washington, D.C. called the Global Engagement Council, and it's a government-funded organization inside the State Department that has tens of millions of dollars to combat violent messaging. And their idea is that if they can project other images, other ideas, then young people will say, oh, gee, I want to go do this instead of that. And that's too late. That's after the cow has left the barn. So then you move on to Facebook and Twitter, and most of the jihadis have migrated off of those platforms. They're using new forms like Telegram and WhatsApp, in which they feel like they're working in a secure environment. But the reality is that the back end of all that social media is easily penetratable. And, for example, we did a test in Afghanistan where a friend of mine from a small village in the mountains said, there's some guys recruiting for ISIS. Can you help me? So I went to my secret school friends and I said, hey, can you run the back end of the social media for this guy and find out who his connections are? So we find out that the guy that's recruiting in this small village in Afghanistan is actually going to university in Kabul.
Jeez.
And this guy does not have a beard. He doesn't look like a jihadi. He's taking a, you know, advanced course. And this is the reality of online jihad, is that there are a number of people that are specifically doing certain things, like recruiting or creating posters or videos, and et cetera. It's a huge part of their campaign.
Are they getting paid for this?
Yes, some are and some aren't. So some people volunteer to do jihad, and they do it because they feel it's part of their obligation. Other people are technicians that are brought in and paid to show them how to do certain graphic effects or how to make videos. But for the most part, it's sort of volunteer work.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Now, you have known several Americans who have joined these groups. What motivates these people, Robert? Why do they do this?
Well, okay, I'm going to be crude here, but the bottom line is that they're idiots. I mean, the one thing that I've found And don't forget, I've been in many, many rebel camps, and I've been in many places where jihadis are recruited and fighting. If someone feels that the government is oppressing their religion and they want to be a rebel, then they should be able to fight. And a lot of those people call themselves jihadis. And if you remember in Bosnia and places like that, we had sort of mass casualties and human rights violations. And so a lot of Muslims in other countries say, oh, I'm going to go help those people. Like, I can donate money, I can, you know, and some actually go there and fight. But the problem is that the people that go there to fight don't have any military skills.
Right.
And then you have this layer of the Americans and a lot of the foreigners in Britain. And I'm not talking about people that came from that country, you know, came to another place, got a passport and went back. I'm talking about Americans that have never been to that country. They get there and they find out that they're used for PR and cannon fodder. So they end up being blown up or killed within weeks. So when I say idiots, I mean a lot of them go there and get killed instantly.
I had a guest on a few days ago, over the week, and believes that ISIS was created by us in Syria to try to get Assad out. Do you think there's any basis on that?
Yeah, but you got to be careful. So context is important. So, you know, we supported a Shia government in Iraq, and there used to be a Sunni government under Saddam, right?
Okay.
So Saddam had his death squads, and they were Sunni, and then we promoted people like Maliki, and they were Shia, and then we promoted Shia death squad. And then we realized that the insurgency were all the Sunnis, you know, fighting the Shia government. So then we hired a bunch of Sunni death squads along the Euphrates River, where the trade flows into Syria and beyond. Some of those became radicalized and weaponized, and of course then you had Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda in Iraq then morphed into ISIS, and then when we started this campaign of training moderate jihadis, I guess we call them rebels or whatever, in places like Jordan, and we flowed weapons to them, they went in to fight as Free Syrian Army. They realized that we weren't giving them enough weapons. They then joined al-Nusra, which is the other brand for al-Qaeda, and that's how we empowered a lot of the radical groups. So, yes, we did, and no, we didn't.
What is happening, Robert, to these groups now? I mean, we keep hearing accounts from over there that, you know, we're annihilating them in wherever they may go. Is that true?
Yes, and unfortunately the civilians are getting annihilated as well because they use them as human shields.
So yeah.
I've been to many towns where they're killing ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and they literally will sit on the top floor with a sniper and hold them, you know, hold off the army for, you know, 4 or 5 days, and then the building has to get flattened, and there's still civilians living in there.
Jeez.
And then they try to flee, and then, of course, they blow themselves up, and then it's ugly.
Would you say the Middle East at this point is just about devastated? And I'm talking about Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria.
Well, I have to tell you this, George, but it's just getting lit. I mean, you read the news over the last few days about, you know, King Solomon imprisoning a number of...
Oh, yeah, all the Saudi royals and the rich people.
And Hariri, the leader of Lebanon from Saudi Arabia, said he was quitting because Iran was meddling in his affairs. And I think what we're about to see is a proxy war, in which Saudi Arabia, the GCC as we call them, you know, the Emiratis, Kuwait, launch troops against Iran. And you know, they launched a missile that they said went all the way to Riyadh, or almost made it to Riyadh.
They say Iran did that, right?
Right, and Iran says, you got to be kidding me. But these are all causes belli. These are enough reasons for, let's say, Saudi to send all those weapons we sold them into Iran, and then, of course, we're going to have to save them.
Oh, my God.
This is a very ugly situation right now.
How realistic is this? More so than a North Korean situation?
Oh, yeah. Well, North Korea, look, you know, North Korea is a dingleberry hanging off of China. So all China has to do is snip it off, and North Korea is done.
Right.
That's the bottom line. We're not going to get freaky with North Korea because most of South Korea will die. So it doesn't suit us to murder all the nice residents of South Korea just because we want to drop missiles and bombs in North Korea. And to be honest, North Korea is not a threat to the U.S.
So far,
yeah, I mean, granted. But at the same time, they haven't changed dramatically. They keep sending these outdated missiles off into the ocean and over Japan.
Hold on for a second, Robert. We're going to hit a break, and I want to come back and talk about this possibility of a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And, of course, as you mentioned, it pulls us in, too. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Rod Stewart has a magical voice, doesn't he? I'll tell you who else has a magical voice. The voice of the hypnotherapist, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, and he's going to be our final luncheon series guest next Tuesday, November 14th. And there's still a few seats available. If you live in the Los Angeles area and you want to try one of these luncheons, send an email to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. Include your phone number, and they'll get right back to you. It is Tuesday, November 14th. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Robert Young-Pelton with us. Robert, if Saudi Arabia goes to war with Iran, the price of oil is going to go through the roof, will it not?
Yes and no. It depends who consumes the oil from Saudi Arabia. You know, we're actually energy non-dependent on Saudi Arabia, thank goodness. But most of our exports come from Canada and Mexico. So it would affect Europe and Asia more than us.
Now let's get into what's happening there in terms of the purge with all the Saudi royals and the rich folks there, like Alawid bin Talal. I just mentioned him. He owns part of Citibank and everything else. He's under house arrest. What made this new king-to-be crack down on these people?
Well, you imagine the Saud family is actually a family. You know, it's what they call a tribe.
Right.
And there are literally thousands of princes who claim bloodline to the king. So the idea being that the first king gets old, he then takes his next brother, and then that person gets old and senile, and they hire the next brother. And then when they run out of brothers, they use sons, etc. So it's a very, very old-fashioned tribal line. But the Saud family were always Wahhabists. So Wahhabists are very conservative. You know, they believe that the 6th century was the purest form of Islam. They also promote the sort of missionary-style approach to religious growth. So they pay for mosques, they pay for madrasas and schools. And they were very aggressive working with us in supporting the jihad against Soviets in Pakistan. And they essentially took Pakistan and made it an Islamic fundamentalist state. So the problem was is that they were exporting this very militant form of Islam. And at the same time, we were buying oil from them and selling them weapons. So it was a very unhealthy relationship.
Right.
So what he's doing is he's basically getting rid of any kind of dissent under the guise of corruption. So these people would be a threat to his hegemony or power. And we like him because he's pro-Israel, he's pro-America, you know, and he wants to westernize.
Mm-hmm. He's the one who's going to let women drive in Saudi Arabia. Same guy, right?
Yeah, of course. And he's going to let them go to soccer stadiums. He's going to open up movie theaters. I mean, these sound ridiculous, you know, in our culture, but these are our major steps forward. But
right.
He has a huge youth population, and most of that youth population does not want to be ruled by conservative old men. So he has a bigger problem if he doesn't modernize.
But he could step on the wrong financial toes, and they could do something to him.
Yeah, so the biggest problem is that he's in a war in Yemen, and they're not very good at fighting wars. I mean, we help them, but they've got a lot of military hardware and a lot of equipment, and they're fighting people in flip-flops called the Houthis, and they're not winning, and they're bogged down in Yemen. It's kind of like their Vietnam.
Well, they'd get crushed in Iran then, would they not?
Absolutely, and this is one of the problems that you have. Once you declare war against the Shia group and then Iran supports them, you are now locked in a proxy war. And how do you get out of that proxy war by having this militant stance is their problem now. So what we're doing is we're pushing them to, you know, start something with Iran. And you see this with the Emiratis. Have out of some scratch, created an entire army that they're blooding in Yemen, and they're also supporting people in Libya and Eritrea. And so this is turning into a militarized area in which Iran is just holding its breath. At the same time, we're also in Azerbaijan, we're also in Iraq, we're also in Afghanistan, and we're putting pressure using ethnic groups inside Iran. It's not homogeneous, right? So we're supporting various ethnic groups that are rebelling against the Ayatollahs.
I remember the movie W with Richard Dreyfuss playing Dick Cheney. They are all in this war room talking about going into Iraq, and he circled Iran on the map and said, "That's the prize." I think they're still after Iran after they lost it when the Shah fell apart.
Well, we have a disease here that started in World War II, in which we looked at the Cold War. We had to have an enemy, sort of a horrible giant enemy, and that was the Soviet Union. And then we shifted that to Islam, and then we sort of focused on dictators, you know, like Gaddafi and Saddam. And now we're zeroing in on Iran. And Iran has always been sort of both our enemy and our friend at the same time. And we've isolated Iran. We tried to overthrow Assad, who's supported by Iran in Syria, and it didn't work. I can see the exact same thing happening in Iran. So that's why we've been playing with these proxy forces, but we didn't do a very good job in Syria.
Why can't we make peace with the Iranians? I mean, they don't want to go to war with us.
But you mentioned Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney had his own secret little group called the Office of Planning or something that brought in the neocons, which are special interest people that want to start a war with Iran. And you have to remember that when the Houthis shoot their weapons or make videos, they yell, "Death to Israel, death to America."
Yeah.
So they have an agenda that they're projecting to us. And so if we ignore it, are we letting this potential enemy, you know, get stronger and stronger? And this is the whole thing about the nuclear weapons and the Obama agreement that if you know, if we pay, give back your money, you won't develop, you know, military nuclear weapons. So depending on your viewpoint, Iran could be our biggest enemy, or they could be our biggest ally.
Well, and I was going to say, would the Houthis still be saying this if we were friends with the Iranians?
Well, the Houthis are, Yemen is the poorest Arab country. It doesn't really matter, but, you know, thousands of people, tens of thousands of people are dying, and Iran is looking at this as a direct threat. I mean, if you look at a map of Iran and look at where the Gulf War is in Saudi Arabia, and, you know, Dick Cheney's thing about they could block the Straits of Hormuz.
Yeah, it's all around it.
But they haven't, and that's the point, is that they need to make money. They're not going to shoot themselves in the foot just because they have a war. So in my feeling, this is the new administration trying to ratchet up tension and using the frog hopping out of the pot strategy, where you keep turning the pressure up slowly, 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 until something happens internally.
Give me your prediction then, Robert, on what you think might happen in that region.
I think you're going to see a lot of bits of Iran become violent. In other words, the areas that we're working with covert agents to train tribesmen, like in the south, the Baluch area, you're going to see some of the border regions with the Kurds getting violent. And then you're going to see support for liberalization and modernization inside Iran, like you saw in Saudi Arabia. Now, if Iran takes the bait and says, okay, yes, we want to modernize, then we won. If they say, screw you, come and get us, then we're going to have war.
I want to get your reaction to these episodes that have been occurring here on our homeland, of course. The crazed truck driver in New York killing 8 people, this wacko who was bad conduct discharged from the Air Force. They never reported his felony, and hence he was able to get his rifle. Is this going to continue, Robert? I don't see an end to this.
No, this is electrified by the media, of course. You know, you had the Las Vegas shooting, and everybody with sort of a weak mind that has an axe to grind that maybe isn't all there sees this as a way to get back at people. They see all the media coverage, they see the crying and whatever, and this has been proven, where you have these copycat attacks. They're not exactly the same, but they're triggered by sort of weak-minded people saying, oh, this is how I can get back
right.
at my
mother. I can do this too.
Exactly, and at the same time, this is a small town, and they knew this guy was a pain. I mean, it wasn't a secret that this guy was weird and odd, and we as a society don't really have the tools to go in and say to somebody, hey, this guy's causing a problem. I mean, we live in an era of permissiveness.
Yeah, I mean, clearly he was sending his in-laws hateful text messages, probably threatening. I'm sure they're going to digest some of those. He, you know, he apparently fractured the skull of his stepson, the little baby, assaulted his wife, you know, got booted out of the Air Force because of it, has spent a year in jail over all this. posted all kinds of hate on Facebook. I mean, at what point does somebody say, this guy's a problem?
Well, this is the society we live in. We're overly permissive with deviant behavior, because if I went over and disciplined that person, guess what? I would go to jail. You know, this is the world we live in. Now, if we have restraining orders and things like that, but you hear about people getting murdered all the time.
Oh, yeah. They break them.
So we live in a violent society. We have, you know, 300 million people. The aberration percentage is small, but it gets magnified by the media. And they just, I mean, you watch them stand around that poor church. The amount of trauma that the media must be causing that small town by constantly interviewing survivors and people like that. So this is an unhealthy reaction to violence.
Yeah. I mean, he went to this church with a purpose. He was trying to gun down his in-law.
But I think he also wanted the publicity. I don't think it was meant to be just a quiet murder.
Right. They're saying now he killed himself, by the way.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think this was a statement. He got chased, and it was a statement. And,
yeah.
And I hate to say it, but we're seeing more of these sort of signature-type attacks, like whether you call them terrorism, whether you call them mass murder, where they have a spectacular element to them.
Well, and I was saying to Tom today, our producer, I said, we don't need terrorism to come in from the outside. It's homegrown here. We're doing it to ourselves.
Yes, and I don't have a solution. I mean, nobody really has a solution except to encourage a tighter-knit community where we understand who doesn't fit in to what we consider normal society, you know. And it's sad to see a small town in Texas be that devastated
yeah.
by one person. But I think the news, the stories will come out, and there'll be clear signs that this guy was a little odd and, you know, acting weird. And when you go out and buy a weapon and suddenly you're threatening people and you have a weapon, once again, society is powerless to react to that.
Speaking of weaponry, how does ISIS and Al-Qaeda get all its weapons and get its money?
Okay. So it depends on the country. You know, ISIS ranges from the Philippines to Libya,
mm-hmm.
to Iraq, to Syria. But typically what happens is they go into a populated area that has a grievance, and they bring in about three or four trainers. They teach them how to make videos. They print flags and whatever, and they start taxing people, and they bring in the thugs. And they literally go door to door, and they demand their zakat, which is like a fee or a tax, which normally is for charity, but they use it to run their organization. They find out who's controlling, let's say, trucking or some larger industry. They put the squeeze on them, and so then they get their money. And then
it's like the mob, almost.
It's almost exactly the same as the mob. It's no different. It's organized crime. In terms of weaponry, it depends on the region. So if you're in Iraq and Syria, you literally have no problem getting weapons because we pumped tons of weapons into Syria, so they're easy to buy. Libya, same thing. Areas like the Philippines, where it's a little harder to get weapons, you have to either import them from places like North Korea or China, or you just have to buy them from the military because the military is also somewhat corrupt. So you have different ways of getting weapons. But at the end of the day, what ISIS is doing, it's like a scab that you picked that got infected. It's not a military power per se. It's an infection that has to be rooted out by destroying where you find it. And that's what they want. They want to encourage people, come join the jihad, you know, come to this place, bring your families, and then basically hold out for as long as they can, destroying the entire infrastructure, turning the government against those people. In other words, being suspicious about, you know, are these people really supporters, and are there secret, you know, agents hiding here? And that's what they're hoping to do, is to turn people against the government that comes to save them.
Would Osama bin Laden have been in shock at the growth of ISIS compared to Al-Qaeda?
That's a good question. So Al-Qaeda was a deviant offshoot of militant Wahhabism. And obviously it was supercharged by the $3 billion the Saudis pumped into that region.
Mm-hmm.
Osama bin Laden was in charge of the Arab-speaking fighters. He felt that this was an army that could defend Islam from invaders. So remember, he wanted to go in and kick the Americans out of the Holy Land. He wanted
yep.
to go into Kuwait, kick them out, and then he got turned down. But his idea was a global force and then a caliphate based on Sharia, et cetera, et cetera. he did not like the violence that was being dealt by some of the offshoots, some of the newer franchises. So I think he'd be kind of appalled at the way that ISIS gets attention, which is, of course, brutal videos of murders.
Horrible.
ISIS in itself is very calculating in that what it projects to the outside is very different than what it projects to the inside. So those murders that we watch are obviously designed to intimidate the local population, but they're actually not abusing the local population that much because they need them to, you know, eat and be safe and work around. So ultimately they try to create these communities where they hire people to do public works projects, et cetera, et cetera.
Is there an organization to ISIS? I mean, is there like a corporate pecking order here?
Yeah, they're obsessed with paperwork. I mean, they have to collect money and they have to account for it. They have to go, they spray paint your business. Like when you pay your taxes, they spray paint a little ISIS logo on there. When you go in and out of the town, you have to get a pass, and then they know that your relatives are still there so that you don't flee. I mean, there's mountains of paperwork.
How many are we talking about here? How many people?
Well, okay, so that's a flexible number. So let's say the three or four trainers go into the Philippines, right? They teach you how to cut somebody's head off. They teach you how to chant, whatever. Then those groups that invite them in become ISIS. You know, they pledge their allegiance.
It's like they buy the franchise.
Exactly.
Right?
So suddenly you go from four or five foreigners being ISIS to 300 or 400 people suddenly being ISIS. And This is the problem with the news reporting on a lot of these new franchises that are popping up. Is, for example, Ansar al-Sharia was the foundation for all the ISIS groups in Derna and Sirte in Libya. And, of course, when ISIS gets killed, they suddenly revert back to being a more moderate form of Islamic group. So they run the spectrum.
Can we beat them? Really beat them? Or are they going to keep popping up?
No. I mean, look, it's a very simple formula. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, most insurgent groups go into regions where minorities have beefs, right?
In other
words, if you're Sunni and the Shias are picking on you, they'll go in there and say, hey, you know, come with us. Let's go murder the governor or whatever. You know, let's go to the corrupt policeman's house and burn down his house and punish him. So they flourish in badly governed areas.
They go to the oppressed.
Exactly, and this is no different than any other rebel group or whatever. Now, it also has intellectuals at the top level, and it has PR and communicators at the middle level. So it's built the same way that the communists and even the way we fight revolutions are. We don't do the violent stuff, but the point is that it's no different than any other insurgent group in history.
Where is Osama bin Laden's right-hand man, al-Zawahiri? Whatever happened to him? He's hiding someplace.
He's not retired yet, but he's pretty much irrelevant. So he used to live in Miram Shah. He may have moved into protective custody somewhere in Pakistan.
Somebody knows where he is, right?
Of course. But he's completely irrelevant. Like, he was arguing, you know, he still sends out radio, you know, cassettes. Like, who the hell can play a cassette these days? He still sends out cassettes.
But he's like the old mob leader who retired, so they leave him alone.
He's like some 70s one-hit wonder guy that can't get a casino gig. You know? He's irrelevant. But the point is that he still exists. He's still supported by Pakistan. They always hedge their bets. And he has made al-Qaeda irrelevant, and pretty much like the Taliban is irrelevant. You know, ISIS pays twice as much as the Taliban pays in Afghanistan.
Well, that's a good point. Robert, we're going to take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.